Culture Affidavit, David, episode 174, The Odyssey. Hello and welcome to episode 174 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that takes a look at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the True True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Panarese. This episode is part two of a two-part crossover with my other podcast, Required Reading with Tom and Stella. Over on the latest episode of Required Reading, Stella and I looked at Emily Wilson's translation of Homer's Odyssey. In depth, actually, it was a 3-hour episode, and you're encouraged to go over there and listen to it. This episode, Stella and I will be taking a look at the recently released film by Christopher Nolan, starring Matt Damon, Anne Hathaway, Zendaya, Charlize Theron, Lupita Nyong'o, and a number of other stars. Did we like the movie? Did we like the movie as an adaptation of The Odyssey? Which we are considering two separate questions. So, I'm going to go ahead and play the trailer for that movie. And on the other side of it, you're going to hear Stella and I discuss The Odyssey. Be right back.
After years of war, no one could stand between my men.
So, like I said, this is the second part of a two-part episode that covers The Odyssey. Part one was over at Required Reading, where for 3 hours, including 41 minutes of synopsis, we talked about The Odyssey. So, right now, we're going to get into the recent movie that stars Matt Damon. It was directed by Christopher Nolan. And the only person I could do that with is my Required Reading co-host. Ooh. Say hello once again to Stella.
Hello once again to Stella.
Seriously.
I am excited to be here. I feel like the last time I was on this show was, in fact, also another crossover. So maybe now I can be called the crossover queen.
Yes. Okay. All right. So I'm going to run down a little, just a tiny bit of kind of data, so to speak, on the movie. Just a quick cast list, as well as a little bit of box office, at least as of Monday, July 20th, which is when we're recording this. I saw this in an 11:10 showing in Charlottesville. I actually put down the extra money to see it in IMAX, and I never go and see IMAX movies. The last movie I remember seeing in IMAX was at like the National Air and Space Museum, and it was about the space shuttle. So I saw it in IMAX because I know it was filmed in IMAX. And they had that available. And you said you went to like a 10 o'clock showing, like in the evening.
Yeah.
That must have been fun.
Yeah. I mean, actually, there were more people there. I mean, it felt like it was nearly sold out if it was not. But that was the issue, is all the sort of quote unquote normal time when I could have gone to bed at my bedtime were all filled. And so then you've got this 10 p.m. and you're like, well, guess I'll have to sacrifice, take some naps, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting experience. I think IMAX was, in fact, the way to go if we were not being lied to in regards to how much was cut off for quote unquote regular screens. But yeah, I did not flag. I think there were times I felt lower energy depending on what was going on in the film, but I wasn't like closing my eyes. So it did work out. But I mean, getting back close to two is a bit rough
That's
for
rough.
my agedness.
Yeah, I saw. I was actually there were a fair amount of people in the movie theater when I was there at 11 o'clock in the morning, which I was surprised by because when V and I went to see the back rooms prior week, we were one of maybe seven people in the theater at 10:30 in the morning. But it was fun. I got home at like 3:30. Yeah, so the movie is directed by Christopher Nolan, who of course people, I mean, it's not like people don't know who this guy is by this point. He won Best Director for Oppenheimer a couple of years ago and directed the Dark Knight trilogy, and as well as Memento, The Prestige, Inception, Interstellar, Tenet, and a number of other movies. This was in production for a couple of years, from what I understand, and was filmed largely on location and largely with practical effects, from what I can kind of glean from it. I actually, prior to going into the movie, I didn't really look up a lot other than casting because I wanted to just kind of go in blind from reviews. I really don't like to go in having read reviews of a movie, or, and sometimes I even stay away from social media so that my opinion isn't tainted by what other people are saying about it. So let's talk a little bit about the cast. I'll list off the cast members and then I'm going to go into how it's done at the box office so far, and then just a couple of snippets of reviews. And I'm grabbing all this from the Odyssey Movies Wikipedia page. And then Stella and I are going to have a discussion. I'm not giving a synopsis of the film. We're just going to have a free-flowing discussion where we talk about what we liked about the film and what we liked about it as a film. And then we're also going to cover it as an adaptation of the Odyssey, because I think those are two separate things to talk about. So it's got a very, very prestigious or all-star cast, I guess you could say. Odysseus, the title character, is played by Matt Damon. Telemachus, his son, played by Tom Holland. Anne Hathaway plays his wife, Penelope. And then you have Antinous, who is the head suitor of all the suitors of Penelope, played by Robert Pattinson. Lupita Nyong'o plays Helen of Troy and her twin sister, Clytemnestra. Samantha Morton plays Circe. John Leguizamo is Eumaeus. Zendaya plays Athena. Charlize Theron plays Calypso. John Bernthal is Menelaus. Himesh Patel is Eurocles, who is Odysseus' second in command. Bill Irwin is the on-set performer of Polyphemus, the Cyclops. Elliot Page plays Sinon, who is a Greek soldier and the son of a servant of Antinous. And Benny Safdie is Agamemnon. There are other cast members, but those are mostly listed. James Remar plays Tiresias. I think that's probably one of the bigger other names that might be recognizable. The amount of money so far has been pretty hefty. It was getting, it was kind of the movie to come out this week. I don't know what's coming out this week, but I know that next Friday is going to be.
Spider-Man.
It is a very, very expensive movie. It was produced on a $250 million budget. It's among one of the most expensive films ever made at this point. Wikipedia says, according to Forbes, The Odyssey will need to earn between $625 million and $750 million at the box office to break even. Hollywood accounting is always fun, isn't it? Reception-wise, it has gotten quite a good amount of critical acclaim. The Rotten Tomatoes aggregation score is 95% of the reviews are positive, with an average rating of 8.7 out of 10. Metacritic is assigning it a score of 89 out of 100 based on 60 critics, which is saying universal acclaim. And CinemaScore is giving it an A on an A to F scale, which is about 81 of those polled at Post Track also said they would definitely recommend it. Peter Bradshaw, The Guardian, gave it a 5 out of 5, calling it a film with thrilling ambition, boldness, seriousness, generosity, and flair. Amy Nicholson from the Los Angeles Times called it, quote, a mighty Trojan horse of Nolan's thematic obsessions, writing that Nolan refuses to tremble before the canon. He cuts and rejiggers Homer and a bit of Virgil to transform the classical text into his type of tale, one fixated on memory, self-identity, destructive genius, and the slippage of time. We'll get into that, obviously. The Hollywood Reporter gave it a middling review, saying it was uneven and no match for the sure-footedness and intellectual complicity of Oppenheimer, but it is elevated by the blinding charismatic ensemble. So then you have some of the more negative reviews saying of The New Yorker, saying that it turns the epic poem prosaic. In Time, Sefati Zakharik called it an eye-glazing dud. Mm-hmm. Odie Henderson of the Boston Globe gave it 2.5 stars, saying Pattinson has fun channeling Roddy McDowell's snarky performance of Cleopatra, but like that epic flop, The Odyssey takes itself too seriously. The film ultimately sinks under its bleakness like a lead balloon. There was also some of the criticism for some of the technical aspects. And then some critics argued that the adaptation reshaped the poem's ancient moral framework to align with modern attitudes. That was that. So we are going to get into what we thought, because I don't think either of us, but neither of us really tends to go in to a movie thinking about what people have been saying. I think I already said that. I know that you, even books, I think you tend to try to go in as blind as you can. I don't want to assume. Am I right about that?
Yeah, because I think it is. Yeah, even, you know, we also do comic reviews and things like that. You more so like the vintage. So, you know, that's harder because you've got all like, you know, years of back reviews and things like that. But for new books, you know, I try not to look at other people's and sort my own opinion out because, yeah, once you read something else, I think you're already maybe slightly biased in one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And then you have to sort out what is your own thinking versus what is the thinking of those people that you have digested. So yeah, I try to be as virginal as possible.
Yeah, same. And well, I think it also makes for a better, just a better experience too. And sometimes I don't even look at the reviews after I watch a movie like this. Especially something as big and as marquee as this. I think the only thing that I had kind of complaining up and down about before the movie came out was the casting. And we had talked about this in Required Reading, is that both of us really love the Armand Assante 1997 TV movie. And honestly, like when I picture Odysseus, who is Greek and therefore Mediterranean, I picture an actor of that region. I think Asante's like Italian, but kind of like close enough, right? That it wouldn't look like Matt Damon. You know, and then I heard some like Tom Holland as Telemachus. Tom Holland, who I think is going to be playing teenagers well into his 50s at this point, because he's like,
he's typecast.
Yeah, exactly. And et cetera, et cetera. So that was going in. I went to the movie. You went to the movie. You said you kind of, you know, you were doing your best to stay awake. I'm kidding. I had one bathroom break. And
you left.
Yeah, quickly. I, you know, that's what happens when you drink a soda. Oh, no. I think it was during the Lystragonian scene.
I think it was the Lystragonians.
Before we get to the Odyssey of it all, what did you think of it just as a film, as a movie that you went to see?
Yes. Oh, and I just want to comment on the casting because number one, I didn't trust any of the casting news that was coming out because I felt like people didn't know what they were talking about, which part of it is actually true. And number two, so I was just like, whatever happens, happens. I think the only, you know, the people confirmed were basically Odysseus and his family. Mm-hmm. But then also people were so upset at things that were like so wrong because everyone was up in arms, because I mean, they're transphobic, about Elliot Page being Achilles. And that was completely wrong. So they just like getting angry for no apparent reason, which is wild. But yeah, there was certainly an uproar. Like people were coming out, and
I think people were up upset about like Lupita Nyong'o playing
Yeah,
Helen.
Helen, et cetera. Yeah, like, is this the, yeah, and they kept comparing some of these castings to those of Troy, and like, look at how far we've fallen, you know, that sort of thing. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is ridiculous. But I think that's, unfortunately, that's the state of the world in which we're in now. So yes, you are quite correct. That was certainly something that I thought about and texted you, just that you, depending on your background, and we're both in academia and we both have a fondness of the source material and can discuss it, obviously, and you know, have read it, that you're sort of split, because how, you know, what posture are you in this film? Are you in it because you're going to critique it as an adaptation of this work of literature? Are you going in it watching a Christopher Nolan film? So I was trying my best to dance the line, but it's really hard because one, I think, very much colors the other. I think as a Christopher Nolan film, and I am a fan of his direction, I think it very much is a Christopher Nolan film, just with its bigness and to, you know, to quote Ms. Marvel, and you know, using practicals and the sights and everything, it looks marvelous. And I think it very much is an epic tale of his own making. So it's very much, I think, contrived. Like, he had this idea of who Odysseus was and made it fit into what his idea is, and have it, you know, come around in a nice way for him. So yeah, I think overall I would say, like, I would probably give it maybe a B in terms of like Christopher Nolan style. The when you talked about, yeah, making it prosaic, that was certainly a critique, right? And I try not to watch trailers because they give a lot away. But of course, you know, once that full length trailer had dropped, everyone was sort of snickering about the dad and the daddy business, because it does seem like, oh, that's a bit strange. And I think with some of the it did, he even said, like, I made this leap. I'll either like pay for it or it'll come out on top. And so he knew that it was definitely a risk. But I think with some of the themes that were going on, and even some of the language used in the monologues that were happening and conversations with between people, it does not seem consistent for me. So I can like decry the language overall as a classicist, but I think just in terms of like a moviegoer, I think he needed to stay consistent. And I did have an issue with that, because we did have dad and daddy, but then Telemachus would also switch to mother and father. And so I was confused, like, why we were doing that. And one could argue, well, when he's talking to the actual person, he'll call them mom, but when he's talking about them, he'll be like mother and father. But he was also talking to, yeah, Antinous, who knows, and said dad. So I just wish there had been some consistency. And with the characters, this is where I think I can, in fact, separate the classicism versus the film. I would say that the male characters are pretty fleshed out. The female characters leave a lot to be desired. And someone made a comment of like, this is true of all like Nolan films, that like he just doesn't understand sort of women, and so like they're always lacking. But they're really, I was having some major, I mean, with Zendaya as quote unquote Athena, I was just like, she's just standing there. Like, she just appears and that's it. And I thought, what's happening here? With Calypso, I think that she was done a disservice. And I was like super confused for 2 hours, because I thought, why is she trying to help him remember, but also feeding him the lotus, which that's resolved in the end, because of helping him sort of acclimate. But that just, it, like, I felt like her story was cut short. And then Circe, just to have this woman who initially was very calm with this pack of men, suddenly then have this monologue that is like kind of frenetic and like very emotional. I just felt like it was bad. And some of it's like the, you know, the actor and actress's interpretation of it. But I just felt like he didn't give them you know, enough to play with. You know, Helen was there. It was like you kind of get into a little bit when she's saying goodbye to Telemachus and kind of that guilt feeling, but she's just, they're barely there. And Penelope, I have a lot of issues with Penelope, frankly, but just like that emotional outburst and how she talks to her son was really off-putting, even if I like separate who Penelope is in the actual work. So it's the women I had the most problems with, but it is like an action adventure story. I think a lot of the sets, well, the settings and the people he encounters, it's like, wow, this is really interesting and unique. And we kind of start to get into who Odysseus is as a flawed human, but I feel like we only just scrape the surface of what that is. And as I was worried about, it very much makes you more feel bad for him, which is what I did not want. Mm-hmm. So yes. So I would say like a B. And I think you get what you pay for in terms of like Nolan and the spectacle. But once you start looking at individual pieces, I think it starts to break down. And that's like really trying to separate from an adaptation of source material.
Yeah, I agree with pretty much most of that. I felt like I walked out of that feeling. And I was actually talking to my dad last night. He thought, what did I think of it? And I said, it's a very good movie. I said, my English teacher brain turns on and I'm going to pick it apart because I'm like, this is not a good adaptation of the Odyssey. But as far as a movie going experience, it was well worth the time. Because something of this scope does need a long movie. Because usually I'm like, movies don't need to be longer than 2 hours. But this is this sort of epic scope that you can't do this inside of 2 hours. You really do need something much longer. And I thought that as far as setting, effects, those sorts of things, I thought Nolan's choices were like really, really well done. I'll get into more specifics later, but I will say that I thought that my favorite set piece, believe it or not, was the underworld scene, because I thought it was really cool to see like Tiresias come out of the black sand and the them drinking the blood out of the shield. I thought like that was played like really, really well. I really thought that was really cool. I thought some of the set pieces, the Trojan horse set piece, was actually pretty well done. And I thought it was interesting how they decided to portray like them dragging the horse in. Cause usually it's like, here's this horse on wheels. So I thought that was interesting. And I agree with you on the women, and we'll get into this more. And I had said to my wife, you know, like what was bothering me was like how the women in the movie, maybe save for Penelope, because she has such a big role that he can't reduce it too much. But I said they were kind of all like reduced to either one note characters or why is this person even here? And she was like, well, it's a Christopher Nolan movie. So I was like, yeah, that's a really, really good point. But yeah, like I said, it's a very good movie. I mean, you know, and it's engaging and intriguing, and it has some great moments. There are some things that even if it wasn't an adaptation of the Odyssey, where I was like, you telegraphed a little too much with the contest in the end by showing him doing it as like a bar trick at the beginning of the movie and a flashback. Mm-hmm. I thought there was way, like if they said Zeus's law one more time, I was going to scream. Oh my gosh. So they were like, and those are just basic storytelling things. It's like, you know, you're laying on this a little too much. You maybe put a little more subtlety into it. And the ending, again, just as a film where it's like you think he's dead and then he shows up on the boat at the end and you're like, you know, did you really need to do that? Like, you know, do you really need to think make you think he died? Like, that's kind of like a cheap movie trick. So again, and this is like, if this was not the Odyssey and it was just like, just a movie about a guy, about like this type of story, I still would have been like, I wish you hadn't done that. But overall, it was a beautiful looking movie. I thought the score was interesting because he didn't use Hans Zimmer, I think, is retired. And the person he used didn't use a lot of instrumentation beyond like kind of instruments that were kind of germane to Greek culture or something. And I thought that was done very well. I know that there was some historical inaccuracy as far as like costumes and uniforms were concerned, but I just remember seeing that and social media back when they were producing the film. Like, he consulted some classicists and then just kind of ignored what they
As
said.
you do.
Yeah, as you do. But yeah, so as movies are concerned, yeah, I'd give this like a B or a B plus. I've seen better Nolan films. I've, you know, but at the same time, this isn't terrible. But as an adaptation of The Odyssey, I think I texted you in all caps, I have so many thoughts about this movie, in that, like, it is, honestly, if I'm giving it a grade as an adaptation of The Odyssey, I'm giving it like a C minus. It's not a very good adaptation of The Odyssey. There are things I will give him credit for, because I've only seen the one other adaptation, and I thought he did a couple good job on a couple of things. But for the most part, this is not something that you watch thinking you're getting the actual Odyssey. And you seem to be of the same opinion when you were talking about your opinion of the movie.
Yes. Yes, in fact. Yeah. That's why it's really hard to sit and watch that film, because you're like, it's really separate. You kind of want something, that an experience that melds the two, or they're at least parallel. But yeah. Oh boy.
Yeah, I had a point, like, while watching the movie, where my opinion on the movie as a movie was kind of set, like, where I was like, oh, this is very, very good as a movie. And then the English teacher brain kicked in, and I just started going through the list of, okay, this is different. Why is he doing this? What about this part? Why did he leave that out? And he left out quite a number of things, or switched things, to the point where I was like, why that choice? We'll get to that. I guess let's talk about Matt Damon.
Okay.
And let's talk about Odysseus.
Yeah.
He was better than I thought he would be as Odysseus. He did not come off as Matt Damon, because, like, I've seen Troy, right?
Yes.
Brad Pitt as Achilles in Troy comes off as Brad Pitt playing Achilles. Like, he's as sexy as he is in, I don't know if you've ever seen Legends of the Fall, like, from
'84.
That's what when I see him in Troy, I think of him in Legends of the Fall. It's like, it's not Achilles, it's Brad Pitt. This was Damon, and you saw a little bit of Damon here and there of what you see from other movies, but he played it very well and made himself, at least I could see, the Odysseus. That being said, it was too much of a weird sort of, like, overdoing the masculinity in terms of the portrayal and minimizing his mistakes to a certain extent. You said he wanted you to feel bad for him, and I get that, but at the same time, like, I don't know, I just, he needed to be more arrogant, and I don't think he was.
Yeah, because the reason why, I mean, we'll talk about it because I see that it's on there, but the Cyclops scene was just so muted from its original that it just was, I think the Polyphemus, like, to a certain extent, I think, like desecrated a dead body. I think, like, he, like, disrespected one of the comrades that had died as they're escaping the cave. And so Odysseus sees this, and then, I guess, out of resentment, you know, shoots him with an arrow, which is really interesting, because the entire time he talks about, like, he will, pay due respects to their fallen comrades, but not at this moment, because he even denies, like, pulling somebody out. And so I thought, that is going, like, you're being hypocritical, because you just said you weren't going to do anything with this other person, and then all of a sudden you're really upset that somebody's dead body was kicked around. And he was, he makes some leadership choices, I think, that are different than what we see in the source material, that you could sort of get behind why he didn't do this. Like, he does lie about the whole whirlpool. He's like, we should go that way, dot, dot, in order for the crew to make up their own minds to go the other way.
Yeah.
And of course, he's not telling them what's about to happen. I was like, well, That's true. They probably wouldn't go that way. So, you know, using reverse psychology, whereas, you know, in the source material, he's like, he blatantly, you know, keeps things from them that he probably should tell them about. And so it's less to get behind him, I think, in that. You're absolutely right that, you know, his fatal flaw, I don't think is seen at all. I would not call this a representation of Odysseus full of hubris. He just seems like he's constantly beaten down and like you have no, you're like forced into a corner to feel bad for him, especially that speech at the end. So this story for me became all of a sudden guilt. It was all about guilt and potentially like shame he felt in regards to like the fall of Troy.
Yeah.
And I, for one, do not feel like, because he's a warrior, I don't feel like he felt any guilt over, you know, conquering Troy. There maybe are pieces when he tells a story, one of his lies.
Yeah.
Of like ransacking a town and raping and pillaging, and he starts to cry and potentially thinking back to Troy, but I don't think that it haunts him in this particular way. And of course we're constantly hearing beyond the, I know we're going to the Zeus's law thing over and over again. We keep hearing this stuff about people from the sea, you know, this dangerous entity that is going to come. And then it happens that Odysseus is, you know, the people from the sea or their crew.
Yeah.
And that just seems, yeah. And then Athena really isn't Athena. I mean, spoiler alert, it's like a figment. That's like the representation of his guilt that's sort of like following him. At least that's how I interpret it, because, you know, Zendaya was actually a priestess and then it's like merged with the petting of a statue. So I just felt like it missed the mark in order to have this man that we can feel sorry for, which I felt like was Oppenheimer too. So it's like, do you only have this one note lead male who's involved with some bad stuff? And so we understand that their bad stuff has happened, but let's feel bad for the, you know, a perpetrator of those bad things.
Yeah, it's like he's trying to shove him too much into the hero box and the hero learning from his mistakes as opposed to the complicated man, which he had such a great opportunity to do this very complex portrayal of this hero. You're right about the Troy thing confused me, because in the poem, his story is told and he's like crying when he hears it, but he's crying. It's because people have like remembered him. And this was like his greatest accomplishment in a sense, right? I mean, like, it's not lost on him how important that is and why they're saying it. It's not like guilt over it. It's like recognition and hope. He had this hope that he wasn't forgotten. So when he's in Phaeacia, yeah, it's almost pride more than it is guilt. So the historical aspect of it we'll get to later. The Sea Peoples actually is a historical thing, and at least and the first sentence of Wikipedia on it, Sea Peoples, believe it or not, is the Sea Peoples is a phrase used to describe an unidentified seafaring confederation or group of tribes hypothesized to have attacked Egypt and other eastern Mediterranean regions around 1200 BC during the Late Bronze Age. And it was proposed around the 19th century. So he's pulling from history in some regard, and he's doing that at the end too, although I think he just kind of read Wikipedia. But yeah, so his, so I got the Sea People, but him was like, oh, we're the Sea People. Again, that was like one of those weird, like, why did you need to do this twist thing? You know, like, it was like one of those weird things where it's like, this doesn't need to be here. There's already a lot of stuff in the source material that you didn't need to invent this in the same way you didn't need to invent the kind of fake out death at the end of the movie. My hypothesis as I was going through this and watching that scene with Troy was that he did that so that Odysseus did not seem toxic or... He was trying to separate Odysseus from the Greeks who raped and pillaged, because he wanted him to be more of a hero. Because the thing that struck me the most was they show them getting in, they show them getting out of the horse, and they're opening the gate, and the gate opens, and there's Agamemnon like Darth freaking Vader and all standing there. It literally is the opening of Star Wars, where Vader stands there and the stormtroopers are coming in around him. And we barely see Agamemnon's face. And Agamemnon, of course, we know was the king of the kings. He was like the leader of all of this. And it's almost like if I portray this, and I portray this like ravaging of everything in Troy, but Odysseus is the one who in the middle of it is like, what have I done? Then that's okay. We can feel okay about liking Odysseus in this movie, as opposed to wondering why we're following this guy as a hero, because maybe we don't want the audience to think too much or something. And that really, but I mean, I don't find Agamemnon a particularly virtuous person to begin with anyway, but the portrayal of him as Darth Vader as in that sense, and this whole idea that like nobody was right in the Trojan War and it led to some really bad things down the line, I thought it was a little too heavy-handed, and it didn't sit well with me, because I think it made the character of Odysseus too virtuous.
And the fact that you never see Agamemnon's face is sort of this idea that, you know, any war is always, I guess we have face, you know, we know who's doing stuff, but it's like you're always taking commands from this like faceless general that doesn't really take part in the bloodshed, but is leading other people, you know, to kill and be killed.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. But yeah, I mean, I was struck also. I mean, if that was a moment for you, I would, this is going to sound weird, but I was struck by the fact that the maids weren't hanged. And now listen, I'm not looking to witness violence against women, but I think that would have like turned people, because he's slaughtering people, which looks really bad. But also at the same time, he's like preventing his son from killing so that his son will not be exiled. So it's like impossibly holding these terrible things in the same hand as like virtuous qualities. But yeah, I think it just dilutes the character, because he is really complex, and there are times that you really are not on his side and don't condone his actions.
Yeah, I actually wasn't too mad about them not hanging all the women. Did Mia Goth played Melantha, by the way? I forgot to mention her. And did she get? Did they do something like? Was there a consequence for her at the end of the film after everything? Because she was the one who, who was with Antonus and everything.
Yeah, I did not see anything. The last I saw her verse, she was cowering under a table.
Yeah. Okay. So, and again, I don't want to see violence against women in that regard anyway. So, but I was just kind of curious as to like what had been done. I give him points for including Telemachus's quest, because that's one of the things that's not in that television movie from the 90s. It's all Odysseus. Telemachus is in there and he's getting ridiculed and everything. But his journey to Pylos and Troy Sparta gets kind of short shrift. It's just kind of in the background, and we were focused mostly on Odysseus. But here they actually have him go to Sparta. He ends up in Pylos, but it's this weird scene that's not even the book, where like the suitors try to ambush him and like end up, you know, I'm like,
well, not again, even the suitors, they like paid out,
they paid pirates that they to do it or something. Yeah And it's just like kind of like Macbeth, and I'm like, okay, once again, this didn't need to be in here. The idea was that he outsmarted them and landed a different place, and I think it does go back to one thing, and I'll bring it up in a minute. But so I was like, okay, I give you points for having Telemachus go on the quest to find his father, but you lose points for how Telemachus is portrayed in the final battle. Because one of the things about this, it's father and son fighting together, and Telemachus claiming himself as a man or a person, getting back at the suitors for what they did to him, as much as it is Odysseus taking back his island and kingdom. And I think that's a very important thing. But then again, the father and son themes of this movie, of the Odyssey, got reduced quite a bit. Laertes is mentioned like once and is not shown. And the whole idea of this familial relationship is, I think, a little too watered down. And it really bothered me that Telemachus's biggest contribution in the fight scene was killing the one guy in the storeroom who busted the hole through the ceiling and then saying dad and throwing stuff down. And I was like, and I'm sitting there going, but no, I even was okay with Nolan saving Antinous's death for last, because that made for a better, cinematically, that made for a better thing. You get the main bad guy last. You know, I think in the poem, he's like one of the first or second people to be killed with an arrow through the throat. So he changed that. I'm like, I can take that, but I don't know. It bothered me that he was like shoved aside like that. It was like a dad's here, and Odysseus is doing that the thing that he did on the boat. So did he ever learn his actual lesson of like, I'm going to take all care of this all by myself, right? And I guess the lesson is that he does it knowing that what the consequences will be, and he has to, quote, go into exile. That didn't make much sense with me either. So I was just like, yeah. I spent a lot of the movie, when I was thinking about the Odyssey aspects of it, confused as to why the story unfolds the way it does. I know that I was looking up trivia on IMDb, and apparently Nolan made the conscious choice to leave the gods out of it for the most part. And because he had originally, like, it was something along the lines of like, he had planned on putting the gods in there and was hitting like a block with them. So he's like, well, I'll just take them out. And so that leads me to two things. One, if you're going to take the gods out of it, you have to take out, then why the hell are you keeping Polyphemus and Circe? Like, why are you keeping the magical elements? It's a time of apparent magic. I didn't get that. And two, what the hell is Athena doing there then? First of all, Zendaya has four lines and emotes. Like, what is she doing in this movie? And second, if all the other gods are just going to be represented by the things they cause, which, okay, Poseidon, I get that, right? The sea and Zeus with the thunderbolts. Why is Athena there just to cry and look at Odysseus and say the occasional line and almost be like he's having like some weird vision? It perplexed me. And even, yeah, so I will let you take this because I can keep going.
Oh, well, before I take it, I do want to ask you whether you consider her Athena.
I went in thinking she was Athena, so I considered her Athena. By the end, I was wondering, like, what the heck was going on? Because at the beginning of the movie, he's seeing her, and she does have a couple of lines. And then Telemachus is with Mentor, and he keeps saying three or four times, you have like the gray-eyed wisdom, which is Athena, gray-eyed Athena, right? Yeah. And then when the pirates attack them at Pylos, Mentor is killed. And I was like, what? And then Athena kind of like, once he gets home, shows up like once more. So again, by the end, I'm like shrugging. And I think Athena is probably the best example of Nolan just kind of stripping down a female character to have her be like window dressing, you know?
Yeah.
So by the end of the movie, I wasn't sure. At the beginning of the movie, I was.
Sure. Yes, I would agree too, because I was under the impression that this was in fact Athena. And you mentioned Polyphemus and Circe. I would also add Calypso, because of course, you know, she is a goddess too, you know, right? Mm-hmm. And so she's offering him this chance at being there forever. So where's that coming from? So I also was under the impression that this was Athena, which is why it made me really upset, because she just appears and looks at him. Mm-hmm. And every time I thought, let's see, you know, the amount of like repeat lines, I don't know what we're like, are we just trying to hang it, bang it in there? But Telemachus does say at least four times, like, you have wise eyes, Athena's eyes. And so I thought, okay, well, does that mean that Mentor is Athena? But then it never happened. When Odysseus was walking up the hill to get to Circe, I was like, oh my gosh, are we going to see Hermes pop down here? But no.
Yeah.
So he just figures out on his own that he shouldn't be eating that stew. But I don't think that it's Athena at the end. It makes it a bit better. better that it is such a poor portrayal, because if we do say that it's Athena, it's really bad. Like, that's an F for me, because Athena and Odysseus are so intertwined. Obviously, he comes up with things on his own, but she's a patron goddess in every sense of that word. And to be beside him and to also be beside Telemachus and help him on his journey, and that is not at all what we see. And I found that very frustrating that, yeah, Zendaya is just sort of staying there, which then all these interviews where Christopher Nolan gave Zendaya perfect and everyone was like resentful in a funny way of her getting that line when no one else has been told perfect by Christopher Nolan. I'm like, no wonder she wasn't doing anything.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy to just sort of stand there. But the reason why I don't think she's Athena is because in the temple, which I assume it was a temple of Athena, when they're ransacking in Troy, you see Zendaya as a priestess being brought up, and she is about to be beheaded right in front of Odysseus. And we don't see that beheading, but we see it artfully done to a, well, desecrating a statue of
Yes,
Athena.
They chopped the head of the statue off.
Yeah, and so I feel like those things sort of merge together, which is why I think that she is this, like, almost his like conscious, his conscience, and is, or a figment of his guilt that is always carried with him, because they like interlock hands when he's telling his sad story. And then I think he's finally freed of her, all of that stuff. So yes. And I think she's called that in there, but she really isn't. And you can't play it halfway either, because if you, it did feel like Troy, because Troy, you know, Wolfgang Peterson was big about not having the gods there either, but it is really frustrating, because the religion is still very much within this film, because the men immediately blame Odysseus for everything that's happening, and Eurylochus was yelling at him during one of the storms of like, pray right now. So not having the gods, I felt like, was an issue. And I don't know how he was wrapping himself, or getting him, what is that phrase? Wrapping himself in knots, tying himself in knots, is that what it is? Yeah, because I feel like it's pretty simple. You don't have to have the entire pantheon of gods in this film. I think you highlight the big ones that are like really drive everything forward. I think Athena needs to be there. I think you would probably have Zeus at least pop in to have a conversation with Calypso, which I think would have given Calypso more depth as well. Hermes would have been amazing. I was really excited. I was like, I can't wait to see Hermes pop down and tell him, you know, how to battle wits with Circe. And then it never happens. And I think, going back with what you were saying about Telemachus, I think it very much infantilizes him, which is what he is like shaping against the entire work anyways, because he's very much trying to grow up and be man of the house and lean into that. And he's just like constantly pushed down by he's pushed down by Penelope. Yeah, you're right. And not taking ownership in the slaughter of the suitors, that kind of relieves him. He's just like lack of agency of anything. So yes, very frustrating. But I think Athena, for me, represents the frustration of all those, I guess, supernatural elements. And you're right. Why are you doing one thing but not another? And you're mentioning Apollo. Is it Apollo or Helios? Apollo's.
He mentions Apollo, which is, it's so there's an inaccuracy there, but that I can, all right, that I can say.
Because it was Helios, wasn't it?
It was Helios. Wasn't it? It was Helios. Yeah, that's what I thought. But they're like, people don't know who the hell Helios is.
So yeah, so they went with
Apollo.
But again,
all right, I'll let it slide.
But why are you mentioning this? Why are you mentioning Poseidon? I mean, that's the same thing as like having them there. So you were just like afraid to pull the trigger. So yeah, I agree with your frustration.
The moment I knew this was going to go kind of sideways in that sense was the scene in Polyphemus's cave. Because first of all, I loved the character, like the look of the, like with the eye,
it horrifying.
Horrifying, like his face was on the side.
Yeah.
Of his, like, it was turned sideways. It was creepy. I was like, this is really good. It doesn't look like comical or anything or silly. It was really done well. But then they did. I was like, why is he having this conversation? Where's No Man? Where's the arrogance? Where is the reason that Odysseus is cursed, that he does this to himself? And he excises that completely. He just has Polyphemus as this kind of like Grendel-esque thing that weeps for his father. And then all of a sudden it's like, so like, why, again, why are the monsters in this that the gods aren't? You know, there were a couple of scenes with the monsters that I thought were very well done. I thought Scylla was very well done because you got bits and pieces of her and it was just a weird looking six-headed monster. I thought the Charybdis scene was pretty good. I thought the sirens scene was done very, very, very well. I will give him total credit for that because you saw the sirens kind of as like these beautiful, almost like half naked mermaids sitting and singing. And he played it very close, except for like the one guy who jumped off the boat. Like, I didn't think we need that, but the wax in the ears and everything.
Yeah.
And him like having all of this kind of like attack him mentally, I thought that was okay. But I think nothing really ever came out of it. But at the same time, I thought portrayal as far as accuracy was done pretty well. But yeah, it's like, I don't know. After a while, it was like, you could have probably done this without any supernatural stuff. It wouldn't have been an Odyssey adaptation, but yeah, you're right. He came up to the line, but didn't cross over where he needed to be to do it. Let's keep in the supernatural. We already talked about, you know, Polyphemus and everything. Samantha Morton as Circe. I liked the scene where she turned them into pigs because it was like weirdly erotic because she's like shaping them and she's getting like this pleasure out of it, and they're like they were eating, and you could tell like that was going to be happening because they are eating like pigs. And I was like, okay, this is actually a really good scene. And I like that she was living in a little bit kind of a broken house and stuff like that. It was just a little bit different what you're used to. You're still kind of Circe in a palace in a sense, but it was not the temptress, which I think of those paintings of Circe that we've seen over and over, you know, where there's something like this strength and beauty of not like a sultriness like Calypso, but like this kind of power and beauty. And it wasn't there, although I thought her performance was good, but then she kind of turned into kind of like a harpy toward the end with Odysseus. And that was like, I was like, okay, now she's a hag. So what did you think?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that scene. So first of all, I don't know if you've seen, have you seen Spirited Away?
Oh, many, many years ago.
The way they were eating, I was like, man, this feels like, because if you remember at the beginning, when they find the town, the parents sit down and they start eating, and then Chiro, I think her name is like trying to pull them away and they turn into pigs. And I was like, oh my gosh. Erotic is when it begins, just like her caressing the faces and everything.
Yeah.
It's also deeply unsettling because she's like putting her fists in their mouth and like, pulling their faces to become that. Yeah. And I felt like, that is Circe. And there is this unsettling calm about her. Mm-hmm. Obviously she plays off in the beginning, this innocent woman who's afraid of, you know, what's about to happen.
Yeah.
And she's very calm. And she remains calm. But then once there's the threat against the crow, which, I mean, if we've read Madeline Miller, which we have, you know, she was responsible for turning her sister into Scylla. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I thought this was strange. Like, what's happening here? Why add this crow? When she just sort of loses her calm, because I felt like the Circe that I know would remain calm under duress, because I feel like she did, even though she was very much threatened by Odysseus when he pull a knife on her in the original,
as he was told
to do.
Bernadette Peters plays her, and she gets, you could tell she's scared by having the knife pull on her, but even then she's very much in control of herself. Yeah. And then it's like, it's like she knows what he has to do. And she kind of leads him there, but here she just becomes frantic.
Yeah. And it's pushing, it's like really hitting over the head, I guess, what her idea is of who men are. And I feel like it would have been maybe more subtle of that. I mean, just the turning into pigs, I think, speaks volumes. Oh, you know, it could have been, well, there was that deer, but yeah, she's just like really going after, you know, who men are and all of that stuff. And I thought this is maybe a bit too much and a bit too over the head. So I was disappointed about that. I was also disappointed that there is no romantic aspect between the two of them, but it also seems, well, yeah. I mean, with Calypso, we can decide whether or not he was forced or not, because I think it's some things have sort of shifted in that way. So obviously I think they had a sexual relationship, but again, yeah, we're like preserving this doting husband, virtuous type quality, and not having that. I also was sad that he didn't return, that Odysseus didn't return to Circe's island, because it wasn't just Tears, you know, Tiresias gives him, Tiresias, sorry, Tiresias gives him directions, but then he also comes back, and Circe is the one that tells him about what's about to happen. More so than she did, because I think she is the one who says that all his men are going to die. It was her, right, in the film? Yeah, and he's like fighting it. So yeah, I just feel like, man, it was just a blip. Like, did you even need it there? That, you know, and when you do that, when you think, oh, I didn't even need this, then you're like, well, what was the point? Because that was for me, Athena. I was like, we could have had this without Zendaya and it would have been fine because nothing happened. Yeah, so slightly, it was cool, and then it wasn't. Basically.
Like all the women in this movie are part of set pieces, and it's in for an epic that is very patriarchal anyway. And I agree with you because we can let's with Calypso talk about Calypso. She's drugging him with the lotus leaf. So the lotus eater scene is excised for the sake of just having Calypso feed him the lotus leaf, mainly so that he'll forget. And he, in other words, he doesn't know that he's cheating on his wife with this woman. So it saves his virtue again, so that he's a hero because our hero should not be morally wrong, right? Like it's way too much in that direction for me. Charlize Theron was a good casting for Calypso. She's no Vanessa Williams. Vanessa Williams in that movie, it's just like, damn. Charlize is very good though. But two things. One, you're right. She kind of dithers in a weird way. I was really hoping for, and again, it's a Christopher Nolan film. I don't know why I was hoping for this. I was really hoping for the confrontation with Hermes, where she basically calls him out on the double standard that exists with the male gods, you know, because that was part of it. Like, you know, and had her be a little bit more aggressive in that way. Otherwise, she's kind of coaxing him home or helping him remember. And it was like, I thought they had good chemistry together. I thought it was well acted. Did it need to be that way? I don't know. And it completely excised Nausicaa and Phaeacia.
Oh,
And I
yes,
wanted
that
that
was so
scene because
frustrating.
Nausicaa would have been a really interesting scene. And him talking to finally getting somewhere on the outskirts and reaching civilization and how that would have been. I don't know if Nolan cut it for time or if he did it because he just didn't feel it was necessary. I felt like he was compacting everything into Calypso for the sake of running time or have not having too much in the script. But then again, it's like, then why are you filming this movie?
I know you're already at 3, why not push it? Yeah, that was a I think Nausicaa was a huge gap, a huge void that we didn't have. I was so excited to see how they were going to do that, with him washing up and her doing the laundry, playing ball, etc. And yeah, we discussed on required reading just the fear of shame that would have come with her walking with it. You know, there are a lot of things going on, and the hospitality was, you know, the Xenia was really hit home there too, with how the king and the queen welcomed him. So there was just so much that it was unfortunate that we didn't have that. Yeah, with Calypso, so of course we had on our show that comment that he was sexually assaulted. I think that that was.
Yeah, that was going around TikTok a few years ago.
Yeah. And so I think we both, I mean, I don't necessarily see it because I think that anything he did willingly. I think by the end, we could say that it's assault because he wants to leave and she's not letting him. Mm-hmm. But I think to say, to picture their entire relationship like that, I think is like, again, trying to put him in like this victim corner. Mm-hmm. That he is not. But here it's like, not only with like the drugs, even though it's like somewhat explained that she was trying to help you acclimatize mentally so that you wouldn't have a breakdown. But, you know, that's already, you know, having sex with a drug person is not good. And then like from the get-go, it's really bad, which isn't the greatest. And to have her say that she's been trying to help him get home all along, like, didn't feel like that's actually accurate. not accurate to the source material, but not, even not accurate to what I was watching on screen. I'll agree with you that I enjoyed seeing them together. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that was interesting acting and good acting. But yeah, it felt all sorts of wrong.
I like the desolation of her island emphasized her loneliness because that is one of the things about Calypso. She's very, very lonely.
Yeah. She just wants companionship.
Again, I thought that was very, very well done too.
Yeah. Yep. And again, missing the gods, right? You have that really poignant moment of like, you gods, male gods can do whatever you want. But, you know, we or any female, like we immediately get punished. So not even having that conversation. Yeah. Just lots of unfortunate misses.
Which, again, in the epic, sort of supports the whole double standard with him and his affairs versus his faithful wife. Mm-hmm. Now, I liked Anne Hathaway's performance. In fact, I thought she didn't completely steal the movie, but she had presence every time she was on the screen. And I thought that the argument she has with Telemachus where she screams, "I want Odysseus," was a little over the top, but it was very cinematic in that sense. But her giving, she gave the character a lot of gravitas and did embody the character with a lot of strength, which I thought was very, very well done. So I thought she was very good. Now, was the character written as well as I thought she could have been? Not necessarily. I thought a couple of the scenes were cool. I thought that the scene where Eurycleia is washing his feet and figures out who he is and Penelope's talking to the screen and he just like shakes his head and she nods her head. I really liked that because it was just kind of like, I liked the nonverbal communication aspect of that and how they were doing it like right in front of Penelope. Mm-hmm. I did get the sense that like, that she did figure out who he was even before the, before the contest ended and everything. But even then, maybe she was not 100% unsure. Apparently, Hathaway trained for weeks on a loom to actually accurately weave on an ancient loom. And I thought that was a very good idea because the scenes where she's having dialogue and just moving the stuff around felt very natural. So I will give her a lot of credit. I mean, she's a great actress to begin with. And I think she did that very, very well.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree. So this is where the separation comes between Nolan and adaptation. Mm-hmm. You can feel her frustration as a wife. I think she is, as a mother, a bit too harsh with Telemachus. Mm-hmm. I'm unsure where that is coming from. Because Telemachus, we know in the source material, does like tell her to go to her room and all of that stuff. So I could see like, if that were what we're seeing from Tom Holland, then I can absolutely see Anne portraying it, like being annoyed with her son that, you know, you've got this 19-year-old bossing her around, but that's not what we see. Exercising restraint, I think, is the name of the game for Penelope, which is why she is so beloved and like I would feel like studied as a woman in ancient literature. And this just breaks all sorts of that. We have yet another speech in the way of Circe that's really pounding home what it's like to be a woman in the ancient world. And, you know, she can't rule this house and all of that stuff, but it's aimed at her son. So it just seems like what it does not feel like Penelope for me. And even when Antinous is with her, besides the loom, like already he has broken social protocol by being behind that screen. That got erotic too. And I thought, is she? Because it felt like she was leaning in. I thought, are we going to have a kiss here? What's going on? So yeah, Penelope, I feel like breaks what we know of her and her strength. I mean, I'm glad she holds on and she, but it just doesn't seem like the clever and wise Penelope that can go, tit for tat with Odysseus. I felt like we lost that.
Yeah, the scene with the almost kiss, I couldn't tell if she was
Oh,
deliberately leading him on and
yeah.
deceiving him so that he just to feed into his arrogance, or if this was like, look, women are weak, ultimately are weak. And it's like 50-50 on that, because I think because nothing, although nothing did show that she was actually like faking it, so to speak, like, because I think they were interrupted.
Yeah.
And I thought Melantho was like one of the better portrayals of the movie too, because she was like, they had her be the very, very two-faced and eventually got caught, obviously. But I thought Mia Goth did a very good job with the very small role that she had. But yeah, again, Hathaway looked regal, did a great job with what she was given. But you're right, this isn't the Penelope that, because Penelope is supposed to be that polar opposite of Circe and Calypso, right? So, and Circe and Calypso are strong but in different ways, and Penelope is strong in this way, and they're trickster characters in a sense. It was just, again, it was all sort of watered down for the sake of Matt Damon as Odysseus, and I think that was like the biggest problem with this movie. And such, because the other prominent woman is Helen, right? And the death of Agamemnon at the hands of Clytemnestra, I thought it was actually a pretty cool scene. I thought, again, I love Lupita Nyong'o, and I thought she did a great job. Again, she did a great job with the material she was given. The Clytemnestra scene, great scene. Her talking to Telemachus, great scene. What bothered me was that whereas in the text she seems remorseful in some way over her role and everything, but in this it was like Menelaus had been abusing her or something. She seemed like an abused, a battered wife in the dinner scene with Menelaus, because he's so like she seems to cower of him, and he keeps turning her head to show the scar that she has on her face. Like, so who gave that to her? Paris or him or whatever? And then at one point she actually snaps back at him, because like George Lucas is just laughing at this, like, Agamemnon actually started the war because of writes about trade routes.
Oh,
The Phantom
sure.
Menace strikes again. But no, it's like, and he used Helen as the excuse, which, okay, I get where you're going with that, and I can talk about that in a minute. But she snaps at Menelaus, and Menelaus is basically like, get in your place, woman. That did not sit well with me. How did you think Helen was done?
Yeah, I sat there for a while thinking about those scars, and wondering whether I could have seen Menelaus do that to her or not. Well, yeah, I feel like part of me, I wonder if it's because like the actor has led to this particular representation. So I mean, Jon Bernthal, who has like a lot of machismo, he's not going to be, 'cause even Menelaus was in the horse. Menelaus is like leading the charge, and I'm like, in the source material, that is not Menelaus.
No.
So I feel like, sure, I think Jon Bernthal's Menelaus would in fact have maybe, yeah, really taken ownership of Helen after that. And so now her one I don't know, well, her one beauty literally is now marred, and so of course she's going to stay there. Yeah, it is certainly interesting, because if we think about the source, she talks with Telemachus by herself, and gives him the drugged drinking all of that. But yeah, she is like nothing. She's got zero agency, which makes you question a lot of things of what was she taken? Yeah, I don't know why she's apologizing to Telemachus. That was that out of guilt? Is she fearful over, Odysseus coming back and doing something? I have no idea. But yeah, she can't even speak. It's really quite wild. I don't know. The only thing I can think is that we are showing in this way, everything that Circe and Penelope are talking about. It's just,
Yeah.
yeah, you see it physically. But no, that was quite odd of a scene to be sure, especially because she's the, well, I guess they both maybe knew, but she's the first one who says that Odysseus is the stranger's father. So clearly she's, intelligent. But no, I would agree. I don't know that I can put my finger on why it bothered me so much. But yeah, that whole thing, I just felt like, what's happening here? Would this actually have happened? This seems like an extreme thing because the beauty is like what makes Helen Helen. So to have him do that to her seems really bad. But yeah, now
Yeah.
she's like a battered housewife. It's like, oh my gosh.
So,
And that doesn't just happen. So then you're like, oh, well, maybe she actually did run away to Paris.
yeah, well, and they didn't make that clear or
No.
not either. It's just she's the face that launches 1,000 ships.
Yep.
Again, I have things about that, but I want to kind of get to that when we talk a little bit more about some thematic things. The last couple of characters I was thinking about is so Eumaeus has such a much, much bigger role. Once again, put John Leguizamo in a dramatic role and he kills it. I thought he was very good, but then again, like his Tybalt and Hera Perrineau's Mercutio are the whole reason to watch that Romeo and Juliet adaptation from Baz Luhrmann. So he's so freaking good as Tybalt in that movie. And he's really good here as the blind kind of like, I'm not a seer, but like, you know, he's almost like the Greek chorus in a sense. Yeah, they add a little bit too much of Argos, like, okay, the dog, we get it. But I thought he did a great job, and it didn't intrude too much on the aspects of this as an adaptation. The other character who was there was Antinous, played by Robert Pattinson. And I think he was like the best male portrayal in the entire movie because he's so smarmy. And at first, I was like, I don't know if I like this, but as the movie kept going, I'm like, this is really good. Sometimes Antinous in the epic comes off as more of a chest thumping, arrogant, you know, like a gorilla, essentially, like, you know, me, alpha male. Here, Antinous is a lot more slimy, and I think it really worked. And I actually think it really worked as an adaptation of that character. Because Robert Pattinson is an attractive person, and he, I don't think anybody but him could have really pulled it off the way he did. I thought he was really, really good at it.
And adding that dimension to like bring shame to his character was really interesting, though
Yeah.
I had trouble initially following what happened with the lot. But then once it became clear with Sinon and all of that stuff,
Yeah.
I thought was really interesting. So yeah, he is very much like a sniveling coward. Even when it was like his turn, or Telemachus is like holding it, I was like, oh wait, my turn. I thought, oh boy. Yeah, so you really hate him as is right. So they very much build that in there.
So with him, with Helen, with the guilt over the Troy, Nolan seems to be making a statement about war and about maybe our current political climate,
Ooh.
because there's something of the on the good side of things, the Pearl Harbor aspect of Helen's kidnapping, or the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the thing that's called the cause of the war, but really is just kind of the spark that lights the powder keg that had already been there. To go back to the Vietnam War, it's the Gulf of Tonkin incident where people, or it's like the sinking of the Maine and like or Lusitania, these things that were given to us as the reason to go into this war or escalate ourselves into this war. But like historically speaking, it is a little sketchy. And the Gulf of Tonkin incident is a great example of that. It's like, you know, what actually did happen, and was it as severe as the government made it up to be? But they just used it and ran with it as propaganda to get more soldiers into Vietnam, and that's really where it escalated. So when Helen's like, "This war had nothing to do with me, and everything about your brother wanting trade routes," I was like, "Oh, I see where they're going with that." And I'm like, I could see that. And then at the end, again, the guilt over the war, the fact that nobody was good on each side, is a sort of like, war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing type of thing, just to be cheeky. Pattinson as Antonis, and then Antonis with the lot. He's a draft dodging rich boy who sends poor kids off to die. And I was like, and he's a skeeze, and he will evade responsibility to the point where he will let other people die and take the fall in its place. So I was like, okay, I see what you did there. And especially with Antonis, I thought the Antonis aspect of that was skillful, because I saw the commentary of, oh, you're the rich kid dodging the draft, and everybody else takes the fall for you, and you think you can walk away from it because of who you are. And I was like, all right, I can go with that, because I see the message you're sending there. So I think he was trying to make some statements about war. But even then, like I said, that's me trying to look into the movie itself, not the adaptation of the Odyssey.
And it's also interesting because would you say that the Odyssey, like that is compared to the Iliad, is that really like the take home that the majority of people get?
No, it's the Odyssey is not all quiet on the Western Front. And I think that there's aspects of all the all quiet on the Western Front aspects of it in the film. The general, the unseen generals making the boys fight in the war type of thing. Yeah, that's not what the Odyssey is. So maybe parts of the Iliad are, but
And what, well, yeah, the, I mean, I feel like that's a perfect backdrop, which is why, they keep using what was that Shakespeare play we didn't like? Troilus and Cressida,
Troilus and Cressida, yeah.
and doing that in different time periods.
Yeah.
What then, and I don't like disagree with you. I'm just wondering as I'm thinking, what then, what place does the Odysseus constantly abandoning, honoring the dead until he has to, obviously, and having to sort of back up why he's doing that? What place does it have then in your thoughts, like that theory that you just laid out there.
That's a good question, and I'm not 100% sure, because I think that ties into his guilt a little, because when he is in the underworld, the dead come for him because he's been doing that. So maybe that's just, I think it's less of a statement on war, although, very much like big wars, like the Great War, for instance, you have a lot of men just buried in mass graves. So then maybe that's part of what he was getting at. But I took that to be more like a character flaw in Odysseus that provides motivation for that scene where they have to run back to the ship because all of the soldiers that died at his hands or in his care or whatever are coming for him for essentially revenge. And then that kind of compounds his guilt. So I took it more as a character beat and less of a statement of anything about soldiers in war.
I just wonder. I mean, how do
Yeah, it's a good
we
point.
as and I can obviously Christopher Nolan is, from the United Kingdom. So I can't really comment on that, but I just wonder, like, if we think about the United States, do we see these people like when we send soldiers off as sort of, well, it goes back to your generals and all that, but do we honor people as they fall, or do you feel like we only wait until the end of a conflict and then honor the group of them? What's your
I
because I
think
mean you're a
individual I
big
think
expert, I know.
individually we do, because there are military families out there who have to deal with this loss, but as a public, I don't think we do. And let's start with the last half of the 20th century. And you had, when the tide was turning against the Vietnam War, Life magazine was like published a very famous, I think it was Life magazine, published a very famous editorial that was like a week's dead in Vietnam or something. And it was just portraits of all of the American soldiers who had died in 1 week. And it was just so many to show the cost of the war, because it's an abstract concept to a lot of people. You see it in TV footage and headlines. You don't necessarily see the kind of really grisly things and really see the human cost of it. That's why we have poetry from World War One about, we have In Flanders Fields and we have Wilfred Owen's poetry. And then in the Gulf War in the mid-2000s, the Bush administration had prosecuted a couple of journalists who had snapped pictures of coffins being loaded onto planes with American flags on them because they did not want that image being sent. And I have no idea what the heck this current administration is doing with that sort of thing, is with this war that's been going on in Iran. I mean, the American casualty rate has been fairly low, but at the same time, and our culture has this problem where we use the military and soldiers as props. Everything from something as benign seeming as a flyover at a sports game or the presenting of the colors. It's this sort of like this performative patriotism that we always do. And then there's always videos, especially around the holidays, of like, oh, daddy came home from the war to surprise me in the gym during an assembly at school. Like it's all performance and production. And yeah, so I don't think our culture really reconcile as a whole reconciles with the cost, the human cost of the war. And then we could get into like how we treat veterans, how we treat disabled veterans, whether they be mentally disabled or physically disabled and things like that. I think on an individual level, we're a lot more compassionate, but on a cultural level, we're not. Couple of things we talked about. We actually talked about quite a bit. I was annoyed that Odysseus's parents were not there. Anticlea doesn't show up at all. She's not, because she, remember, she's in the underworld, and he's like, "Wait, you're dead, and I died of a broken heart," which, or I died waiting for you of my grief. And I've always took that to mean that she died by suicide, but that's kind of like, I've read too much Shakespeare. So the last things, let's talk about Xenia or Zeus's law. And you had a great text to me. You said, okay, so now Xenia is the golden rule.
That's what it turned into.
Yeah, so expand on that, please.
Yeah, well, all of a sudden, so I'm like waiting for the, they're saying Zeus's law. I'm like, oh my gosh, look at this. And, waiting for an explanation. And then we're told that Zeus's law is, doing to others what you want done to them. Like, I think that might be a direct quote. And I thought, I sh if you like boil it down, sure. But I felt like that is too simplistic of a read of what Xenia is. It ignores a relationship that is built and then is honored through generations. And what this looks like and the symbolism of it, and offering bread and wine. And this is one of the reasons why there's so much guilt, is because Odysseus feels he broke Zeus's law going into Troy. And I was like, that's not how that works.
Nope.
War is completely different. They weren't offer if, that would if you had broken quote your idea of what Zeus's law, that would have meant that the Trojans went out on the beach and were offering you bread and wine, and you decided to break into their thing. So I thought, this is awful. What is going on here? This is not the golden rule. It was so weird, so bad. I don't know how many people other than ones that have read it and are in academia will understand how bad that is, but I just could, because that means that every war ever is quote unquote breaking Zeus's law, which is wild. Unless you're using Helen as bread and wine and see, but that wasn't pulled in there, and that would be like a stretch for me. So I was so disappointed, and I was actually getting annoyed with how much it was called Zeus's law over and over again. And I mean, I guess like Antinous is like, oh, enough with Zeus's law, et cetera. So yeah, those are my my thoughts on that.
Again, they were hitting us over the head with it, and I think it was, again, it was shown too simply. And I really don't have much to add to that, because it's way more complex than it is, and the importance of it is why the suitors are there. Like, and or like Eumaeus, taking Odysseus into his home as the beggar and everything. And again, the disguise, because we didn't have Athena,
so
we didn't
sad.
get the real disguises and stuff like that. And again, I thought that really took away from what would have been a fabulous Greek mythology movie. And he took too much effort to ground it and everything. But yeah, he simplified this. He almost made it like, it's almost like he was trying to tie it to Christianity in some way. Not like deliberately, but like put it in the context that people who were they could understand, where it's like, but again, some of the tenets of our modern day religion are echoes of things that were in religions that existed before. Like some of the tenets of Christianity echo what existed before Christianity. And was even separate from Judaism. Christian values are based on basically universal morals, right? You know, like that sort of thing. And I know I'm being very general here, but like at the same time, I thought he was taking something that could have been like a really good look into the culture of the ancient Greeks, and again, watering it down a little too much to the point where like what you were just saying happened.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I believe that. I mean, I feel like we see that with Plato, in the Republic, and with. Aristotle and his, what is it? Nicomachean Ethics.
Nicomachean Ethics. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Like we're already seeing that. So you're right that it has existed before in terms of virtues here. That was very shocking and frustrating.
Yeah.
That you're thinking war is breaking, Zeus's law there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, especially considering the gods themselves were the cause of the war. You know, I mean, the gods, the apple discord, and the gods were on the battlefield and stuff like that. It doesn't, you're right, it doesn't make much sense. And Zeus's law did cause the downfall of Troy because of they had to accept the horse, you know, like they took advantage of it and stuff. Again, it's a much more nuanced discussion than what was there. And I thought he was going for too much of a binary of it. Because again, our culture does tend to be very binary when looking at those things, the right or wrong. I don't think they would understand the golden mean in a way, some people in our culture, because it's not a median, right? And it's not either or, because he said the extremes are bad, like too much of this is too bad and too little and too much. And there's an average somewhere, and that's the quest. And our culture is not conducive to the quest, the journey, being the important part of it all. Our culture is very, capitalism is very results oriented, profit oriented. What did you get out of it? What was it to you, as opposed to the work? You know, if the work's not worth it if you don't have the result. Like, in other words, we don't like failure. Even though we always say, oh, we can learn from failure, we're not allowed to fail. That's our double standard in our society. Now I'm getting off on a tangent, but yeah. The last thing I wanted to talk about really was the historical thing. We mentioned the Sea Peoples, and one of the things in looking this up, and I kind of started falling down a really interesting Wikipedia rabbit hole on this, was something I mentioned, I think, briefly in the historical context portion of the required reading episode, which is called The Late Bronze Age Collapse. You know, this is archaeologically theorized, hypothesized. Things change as more is discovered, and opinions, you know, from the 19th, 20th, and 21st century get reworked, etc. In general, you have the Trojan War, and that really is kind of the last gasp of that society. And after the war, the civilization of that part of ancient Greece does start to decline and then eventually collapse. And the theory are there's a number of factors. Things from migratory, like the sea peoples coming from other parts. And it's kind of this legendary thing, but it's, to me, it's the equivalent of barbarians invading Rome toward the end of the Roman Empire, right? You know, like the forces from the outside attacking these Mediterranean empires. You have disease, you have climate change things going on, you have you know, a lot of death versus that thing. And then these empires start to collapse, and they hit what was called the Greek Dark Ages, and which is where the oral tradition takes over, because the ancient alphabet that was developed during that period is completely lost. And then it gets picked up again as this Dark Age ends, and there's a Greek sort of renaissance, to use a more modern term. So it's kind of echoed later on with the fall of Rome into the medieval period and up into the Renaissance. It's not one for one, but, you know, history doesn't repeat itself. It rhymes. It's mentioned especially toward the end, where the end of the Odyssey, for those who see the movie but never read the book, is that he kills all the suitors. A scene I thought was pretty well done, despite mm-hmm. Telemachus dropping weapons from the ceiling.
Man, he was shot up with arrows. I thought he was about to die.
Yeah, this is a really, really good, well-staged fight. I thought it was really, really good. But, you know, Penelope comes in and does the whole thing with the bed, where it's like, you know, and he's like, you can't move the bed. She's like, oh, you are my husband. Instead, in this case, he shows her the token of Athena, the pin of Athena that he had kept with him the whole time, which I guess, I mean, it's what have you. But at the end, the suitors' families come back and they're, you know, the war starts and stuff. In this case, Telemachus is crowned king and Penelope and Odysseus sail off into the sunset because they have to go into exile, kind of like they have to go to the Elysian Fields. They were dead to be the Elysian Fields, or it was Arthurian legend, it would be Avalon, but it's like, we're going to sail off into the sunset. He recognizes, I don't even know if he says collapse, but he recognizes the society is changing and that people are, and that maybe sometime people take up writing again. Like, he references this. And it wasn't until we were just talking now and I was looking this up and I'm thinking about the end. Christopher Nolan gave us the end of Return of the King. You know?
Going off.
Think about it.
The Frodo,
they all go on the boat and they all, and the, this age is over and the new age is beginning and the next generation takes over. That's not the point of the Odyssey. That's another thing that bothered me about the movie. Like, again, as a movie, all right. But at the same time, I don't find that, first of all, I don't find that very original. Second of all, again, like, I think you really tarnished the epic with that, especially with that ending. And then with, again, where's Penelope's agency in all of this? Yeah. She's the one who's supposed to figure it out at the end and be like, you are allowed to come back.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe that's just my interpretation. But that ending, I was just like, and again, it, like, he died and she walks under the boat and like, oh, he's there. He's okay. I'm like, it was just, it felt cheap, if I'm being completely honest.
Yeah.
With you.
And wasn't he supposed to go on that trip with Telemachus?
I think so.
And do all of that together. And so that would have been a really beautiful, you know, moment between him. And then also when you pull back, you know, just as a film, this is what didn't Telemachus mention that, like, he could just be king to take over his father?
A couple of times,
and so I'm like, oh my gosh, like, literally you're doing what he said he could have done way earlier if you could have just legitimized him, which is another thing we didn't even talk about, that we're told about the elders in Ithaca a couple times, never see mm-hmm. him, which I think was a missed opportunity as well. But yeah, where is this? Like, what, he hasn't even, I would say, developed his own clout or honor behind him that people are going to suddenly follow him as king. But yeah, it's just frustrating that he mentioned that this could happen and they're like, no, we can't do that. And then it does. So come on.
Well, it's frustrating too, because I have a feeling this is going to get a number of Oscar nominations.
Oh, undoubtedly.
And it might get a lot of people saying, oh, I liked it as a movie, and I know we've torn it apart from the teacher, classicist, you're the classicist, English teacher perspectives of what it does and what it doesn't do and what the themes are and some of the cultural criticisms. And I think they're all valid because we're saying them, but I think they're valid. But it's still a good movie. And that's what I think frustrates me about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not a cheap film. I mean, it's not a cheap film because it costs so much, but it's not a cheap film. And it's like a half-assed attempt at a story. It is a very well-crafted film. But at the end of the day, if somebody said, should I go see this? I'd be like, make sure you read the poem. I'm always going to say read the book,
Yeah.
but in this case, this is not The Odyssey. It is a movie called The Odyssey.
Yeah.
So, any final thoughts on before
Oh.
we wrap up?
Final thoughts on the Odyssey. Yeah, it's interesting because I would almost tell people, I mean, I would love them to read the Odyssey, but I do wonder if I would ask them to read it afterwards so I wouldn't like ruin their enjoyment, because I'm not looking to like destroy someone's enjoyment over something. And so if they want to see it and I know that they haven't read it, then I'll be like, you should read it afterwards,
No,
you
it's
know,
a
and see
great
what your
point.
enjoyment is.
Go
Yeah.
read it, yeah.
Yeah. Because I would caution, I think, anyone. And I actually need to, one of my former colleagues said that she saw it on Thursday. And so I need to catch up and see what she thought about it. But yeah, if there was someone that I knew had a background, I'd be like, okay, good luck to you. There are two things. Yeah. I'm actually about to see it again, with my graduating seniors that were
Oh,
in my
cool.
Virgil class. So I'm looking forward to seeing what what their thoughts are on it. Some of whom have read The Odyssey or love Epic the Musical, and some of, know the overall story, so it'll be interesting. Actually, I do want, before we leave, I do need to talk about the Trojans because, I'm
Okay.
pro-Trojan
Yes.
propaganda. Because I have bias there. I loved that Sinan was a part of it because I'm like, oh my gosh, we're getting into some Virgil. Though Sinan is like his character, like definition, if you go on SparkNotes, would be a lying Greek. L-Y, yeah, because he lies. And so I was disappointed that Elliot Page, while he had, a great conversation down in the underworld, did
Yeah, that
not
was a good
get to
scene.
converse with the Trojans, and that the Trojans just like shot, fired, and killed him. And then there was the horse and everything. I was frustrated by, I guess he is the one who says like it's an offering to Athena with his dying breath, but I was frustrated there was no conversation between the Trojans of like they just decided to bring it in right away. And I thought, oh no, why'd you have to make them dumb? Because I feel like any reasonable party would probably be discussing what is the dangers and everything like that. So I was disappointed by bad characterization of my beloved Trojans, but I did like how you don't see any sort of identifying features of the Trojans. They are all, I mean, there might have been, I think there definitely were like women and children and things like that, but for the military, you don't see anyone. They're all in white and their helmets cover their entire faces. And I thought that was interesting because it's clearly, I think we maybe discussed the Iliad and whether could we see whether there was a bias of, from Homer or the writer or writers on whether they were pro-Trojan or pro-Greek, and it was hard to tell. At any given moment, it could switch. But here, it's like we're clearly on the side of the Greeks, and so we're going to see them as they're breaking through and see all the people that are attached to this boarding party, as it were. But you can't tell who the Trojans were. So I did appreciate that we're like really leaning into the bias of this film that we're pro-Greek there.
Yeah, and you see the women and children in that one flashback that we get where his guilt over things is really compounded or shown. Because prior to that, you don't see a lot of it. Like you see them, yes, kind of killing stormtroopers, right? I thought the Trojan costumes were pretty cool looking. But then, like, it's the guilt is he see, like, well, his people are slaughtering women and children and things like that. And that's where the guilt is. And again, but yeah, I think you have a great point about the Trojans there. So, all right. So, before we go, please tell everybody where they can find you aside from
Oh,
required reading.
yeah. Required weeding with Tom and Stella. Yes. You can find me over at the batmanuniverse.net, where I host a monthly show called Batgirl to Oracle, the Barbara Gordon podcast. And that is where I'm tracing Barbara Gordon's history. And I think I'm in 2000, I'm post Infinite Crisis now. So I'm like 2006, 2007. And then looking also at Barbara Gordon Breakout. And
Mm-hmm.
then over at Fire and Water Podcast Network, I do a seasonal show called Dear Reader. And this previous season, which there's actually one lingering episode that I have yet to record, has been very bad. I actually covered the Iliad and its different adaptations. So you can look forward to that as well. Yeah, there's the season finale that's like months late, but we'll do it before the season ends, or yeah, the summer ends rather. So yeah, thank you so much for inviting me on here. I always enjoy when we can do these crossovers and talk not only about the literature that something has been derived from, but the adaptation as well.
Yeah, this was really, really fun, and something this size like kind of demanded it, right? So
Yes,
yeah. All
absolutely.
right. So as always, you can check the blog for show notes and maybe some extra stuff, and you can leave comments on Blue Sky, Insta, Facebook, and I'll read them when I get them. Next episode, perhaps, and that next episode will drop in September. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and take care. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is hosted and produced by me, Tom Panarese. The theme music is Pop Rock by Scott Holmes and is used under Creative Commons licensing. You can contact and follow me via email at popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Pop Culture Affidavit, and on Blue Sky as Pop Aff. That's POPAFF. And of course, you can find episode links, show notes, and blog posts on my website, popcultureaffidavit.com. Thanks very much for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.